This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, October 1st, 2008. From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Tanda Sizwe Shimaringa, sitting in for Aura Bogado. In today's newscast, as the Senate prepares to vote on the U.S.-India nuclear pact, some warn of a nuclear arms race in Asia. The U.S. military begins what may be a permanent deployment of troops to patrol U.S. streets. And in Florida, the third time just might be the charm. All that and more, but first, these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. Somalia's central government has reportedly authorized international powers to use force against Somali pirates who were demanding a $20 million ransom for a Ukrainian ship laden with 33 Soviet-era tanks and heavy weaponry. Piracy off the coast of Somalia has become relatively common, but the military cargo aboard this ship has made its capture a high-profile case. The vessel is currently surrounded by six U.S. warships and monitored from above by helicopters. A Russian warship is en route to the scene. The U.S. Military Command for Africa, or AFRICOM, began operations today. African leaders have expressed skepticism about how the U.S. hopes to use its force on the continent. AFRICOM's command center had to be established in Germany due to the lack of enthusiasm among African nations to host the operations base. Its commander, General William Ward, claims the purpose of the military force is to prevent war and to build capacity among African nations. Skeptics of the program say the U.S. could accomplish more positive results with less resistance by channeling the same level of resources into aid and development programs run by civilians. The UK's official weather and climate change forecaster has warned of a need for drastic cuts in greenhouse gas emissions. Naomi Fowler reports from London.
The Met Office's Hadley Centre says if the world doesn't take drastic action within 2 years to reduce greenhouse gas pollution by 3% a year, it cannot avoid a global temperature rise of more than 2 degrees centigrade, or 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. That's the threshold beyond which the worst impacts of sea level rise and drought become a significant risk. The report says wealthier countries of the world must take a responsibility for such deep cuts in emissions. It also advocates a rapid spread in renewable energy and wave and tide power, improvements in public transport, big shifts to cycling and walking, and changes in diet. That would include limiting consumption of foods that require high energy output. Today's study adds to the growing pressure on the government to abandon the idea of a third runway at Heathrow Airport and plans for new coal-fired power stations. It's also likely to speed up the unpopular building of a new generation of nuclear power stations. Wealthy nations are attending a UN climate policy meeting this December in Poland. Many hope this report will encourage more urgent action. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
The European Union has deployed more than 200 observers to Georgia to monitor its ceasefire with Russia. Russia is due to completely pull out of buffer zones between Georgia and its breakaway territories by October 10th. Moscow has formally recognized the declarations of independence of South Ossetia and Abkhazia and will maintain a military presence in the two former Georgian states. The Pentagon has announced it will deploy around 26,000 troops to Iraq next year. The move will allow the Defense Department to send Iraq veterans to Afghanistan while maintaining current troop levels in Iraq. The Associated Press estimates 152,000 U.S. troops are currently on the ground in Iraq. California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has, for a second time, vetoed a bill mandating statewide universal health care. This as an appeals court upheld universal health care for workers in San Francisco. Andrew Stelzer has more.
Governor Schwarzenegger says the government-run health care plan would have cost the state $40 billion more than it can afford annually. Budget concerns were the same reason he gave in 2006 when he vetoed another universal health care plan. On Tuesday, Schwarzenegger also vetoed a bill that would have prevented health insurance companies from canceling policies of people who accidentally made a mistake when filling out their health history on an application for coverage. As it stands now, companies can cite any mistake on the application to retroactively cancel a person's insurance. And Schwarzenegger vetoed a bill that would have prevented double billing, a practice in which emergency room physicians bill patients directly when there's a billing dispute with an insurance company. Meanwhile, the city of San Francisco's universal health care plan has withstood a legal challenge from employers. The Healthy San Francisco plan requires businesses with at least 20 workers to either pay for employees' health coverage, add money to their paychecks, or pay into a city fund that covers all uninsured residents. The Golden Gate Restaurant Association won an earlier court case by arguing the cost was an unfair burden on businesses. But on Tuesday, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals overturned that ruling. The Restaurant Association says they may appeal the decision to a full panel of Ninth Circuit judges or to the U.S. Supreme Court. For FSRN, from Oakland, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
And those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
The U.S. Senate is expected to vote soon on a nuclear cooperation agreement between the United States and India. The agreement could open the way for the selling of nuclear technology, including reactors and fuel, to the country which, as a non-signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, is barred from receiving such goods. The House of Representatives approved the agreement last week. Speaking on the Senate floor today, Senator Richard Lugar expressed his support for the deal.
It will allow the United States to engage in peaceful nuclear cooperation with India while protecting United States national security and nonproliferation efforts.
Joining us now is Dr. Edwin Lyman, a senior scientist in the Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists in Washington, D.C. He is also a past president of the Nuclear Control Institute, an organization committed to nuclear nonproliferation. We asked Dr. Lyman to respond to Senator Lugar's remarks.
Senator Lugar is dead wrong about the implications of this agreement. It is going to undermine U.S. efforts to stop proliferation around the world by essentially rewarding a proliferator with all the benefits of a nuclear weapons state. That's exactly the wrong way to go, and it's sending the wrong message to other countries around the world.
There are some observers who feel that the Non-Proliferation Treaty, the Nuclear Suppliers Group, and the International Atomic Energy Agency, all of these components are now in jeopardy if this proposed deal between the U.S. and India goes through. Why is that?
Yes, I think because the nuclear non-proliferation regime and the other organizations like the Nuclear Suppliers Group really require as much consistency as possible and a non-discriminatory nature. Now, the regime already has built into it the non-discriminatory aspect that those countries that had nuclear weapons before the Non-Proliferation Treaty was created are allowed to keep them. And that has been a source of resentment for countries like India for many years. And this is one of the reasons why India has refused to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, because objecting to this discriminatory nature. And they had a point in that these types of agreements are undermined when exceptions are carved out, when some countries have privileges that others don't. That leads to resentment, and that undermines the integrity of the regime. Yet now we have an example where India is happy to further undermine that regime by carving out an exception for itself and essentially obtaining unique status as a non-signatory of the NPT that has both nuclear weapons and access to nuclear materials and technology from around the world. It's creating the ultimate exception for itself.
Why do you think the Bush administration would undertake such a move?
Well, their own rationale is the Bush administration has never been interested in consistency, in non-discriminatory application. It's always sought to play favorites and to give special rewards to its friends. And this is just another example of that. The Bush administration has said it wants a strategic partnership with India as a bulwark against China. It's giving this tidbit as a reward for India's friendship, and it's happy to overlook all the damage that it's doing the nonproliferation regime as a result. And that, you know, it's just another demonstration of the Bush administration's hostility toward fair and equitable application of international standards and requirements.
That was Dr. Edwin Lyman, a senior scientist in the Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists in Washington, D.C. The Senate is expected to vote on the U.S.-India nuclear deal tonight. You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. Find us online at fsrn.org. Stay with us. Coming up later in the newscast, the U.S. military begins a domestic tour of duty. The Senate is prepared to give the $700 billion Wall Street bailout a go. Senate leaders say it will have an easier time passing their chamber. The bill has been changed, and negotiations will likely continue until the 11th hour before the Senate votes tonight. One of the sections still being negotiated is on foreclosures assistance. Housing advocates are trying to strengthen protections for those facing foreclosure. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
The new version of the bill raises the federal insurance cap on bank accounts from $100,000 to $250,000. It also includes $150 billion in tax cuts to reach some in the middle class, some paying health benefits, and some for renewable energy companies. The tax cuts are popular in the Senate, but not so popular among House leadership. But Senate leaders hope the tax breaks could persuade enough conservative House members to support the bailout. Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid, followed by Republican leader Mitch McConnell.
There are a few people in the House who would rather we did this some other way. And we've tried other ways. And I say to my friends in the House of Representatives, we've got to get this done. We cannot leave Washington without doing the financial rescue package and not doing this tax extender bill.
We believe that we have crafted a way to go forward and to get us back on track. This is the only way to get the right kind of solution for the American people.
Most analysts and lawmakers agree defaulted mortgages was the catalyst for the financial crisis. The original bill by Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson didn't even address the issue. Both Democrats and Republicans insisted foreclosure reprieve be included. Representative Maxine Waters, Democrat of California, speaking on the House floor Monday.
We need a moratorium on foreclosures and bankruptcy reform to help people stay in their homes.
Housing advocates and some Democrats said bankruptcy reform would best allow primary homeowners to avoid foreclosure, thus easing the crisis. But a powerful lobby by the mortgage industry fought against it and won. Some foreclosure components have been included. It puts it on the Treasury Secretary to come up with a plan to assist those facing foreclosure.
It's very vague. It's very much at the discretion of the Treasury Secretary. And it's language that talks about they may or they can, but there is no requirement that these modifications take place.
John Taylor is president of the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. He has a plan that he says should be written specifically into the bill, that the government should buy troubled mortgages instead of the current plan to buy troubled mortgage-backed securities, the items bought with the money that homeowners pay the bank.
Purchase these loans at a discount, really a substantial discount, because they're really worth a lot less. And so pass that discount, pass that savings, that reduction in the mortgage amount, because Wall Street has already suffered that loss, pass it along to the homeowner so they can be refinanced at a level, a principal level, that really works for the homeowner, that matches their ability to pay.
Taylor says this plan would allow people facing balloon payments and adjustable rate mortgages and those whose payments are higher than the worth of their home the ability to settle in a mortgage with prime rates. Negotiations are continuing on the foreclosure part of the bill. The Mortgage Banking Association, which opposes any direct foreclosure relief because they could lose money, is also involved in negotiations. They did not respond to repeated requests for comment. As discussions continue, John Taylor points to one component that is completely ignored.
The practices that created this problem in the first place, they're still legal. The Congress has yet to pass what we call anti-predatory lending legislation, which would prohibit the kind of malfeasance that occurred in the industry, in which people were able to make loans regardless of the borrower's ability to pay.
More than a quarter of a million foreclosures occurred in August. According to the Reinvestment Coalition, that's compared to a quarter of a million foreclosures in all of 2000. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Beginning today, October 1st, the U.S. Military Brigade will start its first permanent domestic tour of duty. The 3rd Infantry Division's 1st Brigade Combat Team will be employed by the U.S. Northern Command to patrol U.S. streets and provide security for convoys during man-made or natural disasters. Jinka Soderberg has more.
While disaster relief and response to domestic attacks has long been under the domain of the National Guard, the U.S. military has been moving into these functions more and more over the past few years. Troops were deployed in Louisiana after Hurricane Katrina, during floods in Iowa, and in Texas last month after Hurricane Ike. But some fear that domestic use of the military may be for more than disaster relief and emergency response. In recent months, several U.S. cities were subjected to urban guerrilla warfare training exercises, which involved low-flying helicopters carrying armed soldiers over residential areas. Zeke Martin was shopping in downtown Portland, Oregon in August when military helicopters began their exercise in the city.
I don't honestly know how many there were because I quickly realized that they were flying circles. They were flying low and fast and angry, and these were not media helicopters. My initial reaction was that, oh, there's a fancy corporate helicopter taking off. Something must be happening. When I realized they were just flying around, I became angry and extremely scared.
When the exercises took place, the city of Portland did not give the public or the media advance notice, even though months earlier the mayor's office signed a letter of permission. The letter granted the military permission to perform a number of military maneuvers in downtown Portland, including the use of live ammunition. When pressed as to why the city would permit the use of live ammunition, spokesperson John Dussart admitted the mayor did not know the content of the agreement he signed.
We were assured that there would be no ammunition used.
Then I just don't understand why the letter says that low-power training ammunition and simunition is part of the permission granted.
You know, I think it was an oversight.
Dussart said the purpose of the exercises was to train military forces going to Iraq. But Randall Howington, a Portland resident who witnessed the helicopter flights, is not convinced.
It's not for Iraq. It's for the potential for deployment of the U.S. forces in the continental U.S. The fact that they're doing touch-and-goes and drop-offs in downtown Portland, figuring out what their sight lines are for firing their weapons. It's crazy that they're even practicing that, because you only practice on site if you're going to do something on site.
The new domestic deployment of troops will come under the authority of NORTHCOM, or the Northern Command, which was created by George Bush in 2002 in order to defend the homeland in the so-called War on Terror. Some civil liberties groups, including the American Civil Liberties Union, have criticized the creation of NORTHCOM, suggesting the Bush administration was acting in violation of the posse comitatus tradition that keeps the military and police separate. David Genesta, the director of training programs at NORTHCOM, says that this is not the case.
It's very important to distinguish between defense support of civil authorities, in which we remain in a Title 10 status, and posse comitatus basically says that when we're in the Title 10 status, we cannot conduct inherently law enforcement activities. And so the kinds of support that we would provide do not violate the posse comitatus act.
Title 10 of the U.S. Code says that the military cannot carry out arrests or engage in other policing functions except during national emergencies. A national emergency has been in effect since just after the September 11th attacks and has been renewed by George Bush each year since then. In addition to the Posse Comitatus Act, civil liberties groups say that the use of the military in domestic situations may violate the Constitution itself. But for the 3rd Infantry Division's 1st Brigade Combat Team, coming straight from 3 years of combat in Iraq, constitutional issues do not seem to be a concern. Although the brigade commander did not return FSRN's calls for comment, the military's public response has been that it is not their job to consider the political issues involved, for they are just following orders. But the idea of the use of military troops in domestic situations began before September 11, 2001. A 1999 Department of Defense report calls for an offensive and defensive domestic military plan in which the Department of Defense takes the lead. In interviewing Portland residents on the street, everyone I spoke to was concerned about what the use of the military means for democracy in the U.S. Al Bradbury said she's worried, both about the militarization of police forces and the use of military as police.
There's an increased merging of the police and the military getting between us and our ability to see even what's going on. It seems like another creeping step towards fascism, and I don't like to see our country moving in that direction.
Though the military downplays these concerns, a number of congressional representatives, including Congressmember Dennis Kucinich, have voiced their outrage that the military would be used in this way. And Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy stated that the use of the military for domestic purposes violates the very reason the founding fathers of the U.S. set up our government with a separation of powers. For FSRN, this is Jenka Soderberg in Portland, Oregon.
Following hanging chads and other problems plaguing the 2000 election, many of Florida's counties switched to touchscreen machines in which there was no paper trail of votes. Because of problems with those computerized systems, including 18,000 undercounted votes in a very close 2006 congressional election, the state moved to an optical scan system with a paper trail, beginning with the primary election on August 26th of this year. Voters bubble in an oval on these paper ballots, which are then read by a machine and can be recounted by hand in a disputed election. WMNF Community Radio's Sean Kinnun spoke with voters in Tampa to see if they felt confident in Florida's new voting machines.
Oh, I think it's excellent. I'm very pleased they changed. I never supported what we had the last few elections without a paper trail. At least I don't think it had a real paper trail. This is much better, in my opinion. And if there's a contest of the election, it's easy to go back and actually have a legitimate recount.
I like the bubble. I had no problem with it. There was a lot of problems, I know. But I do like the fact that this is easier. And if it counts the votes, that's all I care about. Thanks. Correctly.
It was very easy. I was surprised when I went in that it wasn't going to be the touch, which I thought was wonderful and easy. But apparently, you know, people still having problems with it. But this was very easy. It was kind of like the bubbles you do in school, you know, on a standardized testing. It was very easy. And I felt very confident that there weren't going to be any problems. It's a very clean-cut voting process today.
It's harder. You got to read it, make sure you know what you're doing. Other than that, it's pretty easy, but there was nobody here, so I don't know what it's going to be when it's a lot of people.
Well, I was surprised by it. I you know, when she gave me the paper, I was like, what's this for? I think it will slow down the process some, though, just due to the fact that it's new and, you know, you actually have to circle something and you know, so the lines may move a little bit slower, but if we have a paper trail to follow, that's fine.
Every time they change something, there is a problem one way or the other. So I'll have to see first what happens, you know, before I can say which I like the best.
Well, time will tell. It appears to me, though, when I voted, I felt as though I had confidence with this one. When they had all them cotton-pick computers and depended on somebody from someplace else to count it, I did not trust it and still don't.
WMNF Community Radio's Sean Kinnun recorded and produced today's installment of Street Beat, interviewing Tampa residents about Florida's new voting machines. Hospitals around the world are taking measures to prevent the spread of superbugs and hospital-acquired infections like MRSA, the antibiotic-resistant bacterium. Healthcare professionals estimate that around 1 in 10 hospital patients worldwide suffer from these infections, and of those, thousands die. In 2007, More people in the United States died from MRSA than from AIDS, according to the Centers for Disease Control. As Cinnamon Nippard reports, these increasing numbers of superbugs pose a serious threat to humans and healthcare systems around the world.
Nosocomial infections are those patients catch at the hospital. 80% of all nosocomial infections fall under four main categories: urinary tract infections, blood infections, surgical site or wound infections, and pneumonia infections. That's according to Dr. Martin Milke, head of the Hospital Hygiene Department at the Robert Koch Institute, Germany's central federal institution responsible for disease control and prevention.
Hospital-acquired infections are mainly those that are in the context of devices. Patients that have to be ventilated or have a urinary tract catheter, or those who have a surgery and suffer from post-surgical wound infections.
The World Health Organization estimates that between 5 to 10% of patients in the developed world acquire nosocomial infections, while in the developing world, the rate of infection is 2 to 20 times higher. These alarming figures have prompted the WHO to launch the first global strategy called Clean Care, Safer Care, which aims to raise awareness of nosocomial infections, as well as providing education and technical solutions. Dr. Benedetta Allegranzi is an infectious diseases specialist working on the World Alliance for Patient Safety Program at the WHO.
The most important action is hand hygiene promotion worldwide, through the use of alcohol-based hand rubs as the best practice, but also promoting education, promoting evaluation of best practices in terms of prevention, and also promoting a patient safety climate, and trying to convince managers and healthcare workers to consider patient safety as a priority.
The European Centre for Disease Prevention and Control, or ECDC, estimates that around 3 million people across the European Union acquire a nosocomial infection, and up to 50,000 people die from those infections each year. The ECDC is taking steps to standardise the monitoring and evaluation of hospital practices across the member states, including evaluating antibiotic use, antibiotic-resistant bacteria, and the prevalence of nosocomial infections. But Dr. Martin Milke has found several obstacles to reducing these hospital-acquired infections.
Time for education is one of the problems. The other problem is that the ratio of nurses to patients goes down because of saving of costs in hospitals. So the less nurses you have, the more patients they have to treat, so nosocomial infections may be distributed easier.
According to the European Centre for Disease Prevention and Control, up to one-third of nosocomial infections could be prevented by following hospital hygiene guidelines, like proper hand washing. While Rockefeller University professor Dr. Vincent Fischetti is working on scientific solutions to target these superbugs, he says that hospitals and medical staff have no excuse for the current rate of infections.
In countries where they've taken this seriously, it works. In the Scandinavian countries, for example, it works quite well. I think it's just laziness. They are not taking it seriously. They don't wash their hands on a regular basis. They don't change gowns because they're moving from patient to patient. And it's also an ingrained experience where they've never done it before, so it's hard to change an old dog and give them new tricks. And so therefore, they have to start re-educating these individuals.
As of the 1st of October in the US, state hospitals will no longer receive Medicare reimbursements for certain hospital-acquired infections. Fischetti says tougher financial sanctions on healthcare providers are necessary, and he's not surprised that more people are taking out lawsuits against hospitals when many of these infections could have been prevented. Cinnamon Nippard reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Berlin.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. You can send your feedback to comments at fsrn.org. Our newscast is produced by Catherine Kopp and Vinod Jones. Leanne Caldwell is our Washington, D.C. editor, and Shannon Young is our headlines editor. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Tandisizwe Shimaringa, sitting in for Auro Bogado.